Harlem in Havana. It's new work from Joni Mitchell, the album Taming the Tiger. I'm Chris Doritos. It's Morning Becomes Eclectic on KCRW with Joni Mitchell. It's so good to have you back.
Thanks. It's fun to be here.
I recognize Wayne Shorter on the horn there. And I know that Brian Blade's on the record, too. Is he on that track?
Yes.
On drums?
Yeah.
But I have no liner notes, so I'm kind of at your mercy to
okay.
Who else is on there?
Well, I'll tell you how it was built. I got a new instrument and an electric guitar with a lot of presets and a lot of colors to kind of fiddle around with, and I found this color. And all of the palette is accessible only by standard tuning. I've only written one song in standard tuning, Urge for Going, and then I went into open tuning land and never looked back. So in order to play around with these colors, I had to go back into standard tuning. Well, the fingering from open tunings has become eccentric, so even when I go into standard, I really don't know my way around the neck. So one night I was sitting in the studio and just kind of moving the dial from color to color to color. There are Clapton sounds in there and,
really?
Jimi Hendrix sounds and all different
any Joni Mitchell
kinds
sounds?
Of colors. No, no, all the history of electric guitar is kind of
I see.
In this palette. And some strange sounds like that, which is a color called crystal, kind of a glass mallet, marimba, hammered sound. So I started playing around with it, and that music came up, and Brian and I jammed it down, and that's the basis of this track. So it was just the two colors. And because it was woody and mallet-struck sounding, he played drums with basically toms and mallets also. And it was a very sheet of sound, like a carnival ride running over wooden rungs. That's what it reminded me of.
Hmm.
And we called it, or I named it, before it had a text, Zulu Tangle, because it's got a little tango motif in the chorus. So it sat around in the can as just this jam called Zulu Tangle. And all of a sudden, I remembered this incident in my childhood. In my childhood, I lived in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan during my high school years. And in the seventh and eighth grade, when all through high school, they used to come to our town every summer, the mile-long midway, which I believe came up from Florida. And at the end of the midway, there was a double Ferris wheel. Club Lido was along the side. So there were a lot of girly shows. But at the very end of it, right next to the Caterpillar and the double Ferris wheel, was a show called Harlem in Havana. And the locals basically said to us, don't even get caught standing there. That was the warning from mothers. Don't let me even see you standing there. And all it was black burlesque. So
why were they saying that, you think?
It was too exotic. You know, it made them nervous. Anyway, we did go, and we did stand there, my friends and I. And
of course.
It was the first time that I heard live black music, and it was Afro-Cuban, basically. But it was the big band, big horn section, and they were playing a lot of contemporary hits. Night Train, in particular, was the song that I remember them playing, but so very, very slow, way back on the beat, eat a sandwich between beats kind of time. You know, real humid weather music. And when I was 14, a girlfriend of mine, who in the song is, I call Emmy Mae, ran off with someone in the band. And this was the scandal of the neighborhood, and came back with bleach blonde hair. And I was forbidden to keep her company, which, of course, you know, I did. And the following year, we went to Harlem and Havana. And this is what the song is based on, because she got us in. And we were minors. You had to be 16 to get in, because it was kind of Red Fox humor and mild striptease, you know, nothing major. Actually, it was kind of tame once we got inside, you know.
More burlesque or something.
It's more, yeah, it was burlesque, basically.
So from the front of that tune, the sounds we're hearing are all produced by the guitar.
The very opening sound is just me playing guitar. Then Brian enters. Then from the palette of guitar sounds that are in it, I began to layer up. I played all the bass on this album, but in a few cases I had Klein play what I had, Larry Klein, my husband, my soon-to-be ex-husband, play what it basically I had played. So as writ, you know, this is pretty much a composed album, this one.
Well, the instrument that you're referring to, you call it a, I'm trying to remember the name of it.
It's a guitar, but it's the sound. The preset is called Crystal.
Right, but the actual
The VG8.
VG8, thank you. Which is the
computer guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really, from what I understand, kind of broke down a block for you and during the making of this album.
No, not even during the making. This album probably wouldn't have occurred. I'd gotten to the point where, well, this is my 20th record, where the process of making records is enjoyable to me, and I still have growth potential, but the business and the marketing had become unbearable, and the press and everything that followed it was just absolutely distasteful to me, and I'd painted myself into a corner where the tunings wreak havoc on the neck of acoustic instruments, and I spent a tremendous amount of time in concert tuning, you know. So I just felt that I didn't want to do it anymore, that I wanted out of the business. I'm a painter first anyway, you know, and I've always, I got seduced into music in art school, and I really felt at this particular time in my life that the energy had gone back to the painting and away from the music. I was uninspired. And so I took my final concert in New Orleans. It was to be my swan song. Well, the Sunday before, the Saturday that I played in New Orleans, a local merchant, Freddie Wallachie, called me up from Westwood Music, and he said, Joan, this Sunday we're having some Roland distributors here demonstrating this instrument. And he knew that I'd been looking for some kind of a gizmo that would hold my tunings. And there were kind of rough mechanical versions of it around, you know, like where the bridge was altered or something. But this, you know, so I went over for the demonstration and they wanted to show me all of the features. And I said, you know, really, I'm not interested in any of this. All I've been told is that it will hold my tunings, that we can take over these stock sounds and use the brain space, so to speak.
To store your tunings.
To store my tunings.
Wow.
That's what I want. So they kept trying to pitch it and show me what it would do. I said, I don't care about any of this. Just show me that you can put one of my tunings into it. You know, let's see how this works. So we put a couple of tunings in, and there you were, really in standard tuning, so with normal guitar players' problems. But it was being lied to digitally and told that it was in these tunings. So the tension of the strings was normal, and therefore the ruining of instruments was not present.
Right.
The warping of necks and, you know, all the stress and strain that I had put on the guitar physically by playing it in a way that it wasn't intended, you know, seemed to be corrected within this instrument. So I was very excited. And on the spot, I asked them to distill a signature sound for me, so we came up with a modified Stratocaster sound. Initially, the guitar programmer was a linear player. I'm a chordal player, and I play very peculiar chords, I'm told, you know, like hybrid chords. And they move quickly from one to the other. He put a lot of flap on it, which is good if you're playing single lines, you know, and so it was kind of blurry. But in that rudimentary state, I went to the New Orleans Jazz Festival and took it out on stage with it flapping. And they were horrified. The Roland executive said, you know, oh, no, you're going to have to woodshed with this thing for quite a while. I said, oh, no, you know, I'm playing my swan song, my final concert this coming Saturday. This is it, you know, like I'm taking this out. If I like it, I stay in the business. If I don't, you know, I'm gone.
Nothing like a little pressure.
So anyway, I went and did it, and the audience, like some of them were aghast, and some of them saw that it had potential, and some of them even liked it. So, you know, it gave me a new toy to play around with, and that coupled with Brian Blade, you know, as a musical partner, you know, we were off on these kind of new adventures. And so that's how the album began, with just Brian and I. Then Freddie, midway through the same merchant, midway through the program, introduced me to another Roland instrument. Just a piano, you know, with a lot of piano sounds, stock piano sounds, every kind of grand piano, honky-tonk piano, and the few more synthetic sounds, 64 presets, I think it has altogether. So with that new toy, I began to layer, and the next thing we knew, it started turning into this kind of symphonic piece. And I became my own bass player for the bulk of it, having worked with the best bass players in the world. It was kind of a humbling situation, but a learning process also. So it was a great musical adventure.
You call Brian Blade your musical partner on this project, and our audience will know him for his work with Daniel Lanois and Emmylou Harris and Joshua Redman.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got his own solo album coming sometime soon, too, doesn't he?
He's got his own band now, the Brian Blade Fellowship, which is a big band, big, you know, three horns. And
I think Blue Note is putting out soon or something.
Yeah, I've heard it's beautiful.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, the first song that was completed for this album was
Man from Mars.
Man from Mars.
That was for a film project. When I went to the meeting, they, you know, I was invited by my husband, who was musical director on the film, you know, to speak with the director. And I
told... This was Allison Anders.
Allison. Yeah. I told Allison, I said, look, you know, I'm blocked right now. The only thing you'll be getting out of me is an I Hate Show Business song. She said, that would be fine. I hate it too. I just ran the press gauntlet, you know. Well, shortly after that, I love cats. I've got four cats now. But my beloved Nietzsche ran off for 18 days. Well, the eve that he departed, my grief was so similar to the heroine of the movie that I kind of tapped into it. I started writing the film, tapping into my actual grief at the moment and her theatrical grief. So the song lies somewhere between her feelings and mine, hers because her boyfriend drowns himself, mine because my beloved cat was at large. And anyway, it took me 17 days to write the song. On the 18th day, he came back.
Really?
Yeah. And the thing is, he's a dancing cat. I have two dancing cats. He dances standing on his hind legs, and he does this to express affection. And he dances around to this song. The first time that he deviated from his pattern, which is dancing down the stairs, this sounds so strange. he just stood on his hind legs. There's built into the music, it's the deepest mix on the record. There are things way, way, way in the distance because of all of those 17 nights that I went out into the neighborhood calling him and listening deeply. You could hear freeways far away and, you know, water dripping off of leaves because the sprinklers just went off in someone's yard, and the flap and the thump of night birds and, you know, critters rustling in the grass and
so it's
distant
all there?
Horns. And, you know, there is... If you listen in the mix, as much as music can depict those things, I've tried, and I think I've captured the event to my cat's satisfaction.
Since I lost you, I can't get through the day without at least one big boo-boo. The pain won't go away. What am I gonna do? Man from Mars, by the dark. time you went too far.
That's from the new album from Joni Mitchell, Taming the Tiger. And that's simply you and Brian Blade.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Blade doing the drum work and everything else is you.
Mm-hmm. And it's mostly guitar, playing all of the horns.
Bass, you're on bass as well.
Yeah, it's my fledgling. That's my first time as a bass player.
That's your first time playing bass on record?
Well, it's keyboard bass. You know, oh yeah, I mean, from the beginning, but it wasn't until my fifth album that I put a band on, because the rhythm section always had a very difficult time with my music. They'd play and it would be so disappointing I'd take it off, right? So I've always been picky about the rhythm section, and because of it I've played with great bass players,
Jocko,
and drummers, you know, yeah, of my generation, and the one before even, you know, like I've played with great people. But prior to Jocko, Max Bennett, who's a fine bass player, I had ideas about the bass that I was telling bass players that I wanted them to do that were pretty progressive, I guess, in retrospect. And they were saying, no, the bass doesn't do that, Joni. It's a team player. It's a supportive instrument. And, you know, having played this record myself, some of the things that I told myself to do as the producer, talking to the bass player, I really have sympathy with bass players that I've worked with before now, you know, and a greater respect for the simplicity of Max Bennett's playing on Court and Spark, for instance, because I wanted him to go up and move around and do more of the things that Jocko was doing. I mean, on the next projects, you know. Matter of fact, it was a bass player that said, look, you know, Joan, you know, there's this really weird bass player who plays with Bob Hope and Phyllis Diller, and you should send for him. He's really weird. You like him.
Phyllis Diller?
That's who Jocko was playing with when I...
I had no idea he played with Phyllis Diller.
He was playing in hotels. You know, he was just a kid before he played, you know, with Weather Report or myself. So I sent for him sight unseen on the word of this bass player who I was asking to do things that he refused to do. He said, well, this weirdo will do them for you. So Jocko was kind of the bass player of my dreams in a certain way, and that he was doing things that I felt the bass could and should do that no one would do, you know, like Jocko was trying to be and was being Jimi Hendrix on the bass.
Is taking what it out front. Doing.
Yeah, and I just kept thinking, you know, well, the bass doesn't do that, bass players kept saying to me. Why, I'd say. Well, I know a lot of the whys now, having played, you know, some of the things that I told myself to do and tried were pretty strange.
Like what?
On this record. Oh, it's just notes. I can't really describe it. I'd have to play you what, you know, just ideas that I had that that failed. So this bass playing is fairly meat and potatoes.
But the why of it? I mean, you found out the why of it.
Well, the thing was that I, you know, they say women hear the high end first anyway, that, you know, maybe because babies cry and we're designed to hear high end frequencies. But, you know, I worked my way down from what was considered strange upper harmony anyway. I had a strange harmonic sense, so I was asking the bass to do things on the bottom. They would say, well, that's not the root of the chord. I was asking them to do rhythmic and harmonic things that they wouldn't, that they thought were not hip. I was also hip at the time that I began working with bass players. It was a very dead sound, and I wanted a resonant sound, and so you were asking people to go against the vogue, and people don't like to stick out. There aren't that many people that like to take chances. They're afraid to be unhip. You know, to be the leader of the next hip, you have to be willing to be unhip.
Especially when you're taking from the jazz crowd like that.
Yeah. You know, so, and I was a woman too, and they think, oh, isn't that cute? She's telling us our business, you know. And but as I began to work with great jazz musicians, like when Wayne came in on this project, he went, oh, they're never going to know where one is, you know, or... Whereas there were other players that came in and were intimidated by the rhythms on this record. And I find that hard to believe, especially from jazz musicians. But my music isn't jazz. It's wide like jazz. It's polyrhythmic like jazz. But it isn't jazz. So, you know, I'm asking them to step into an idiom that isn't quite familiar.
The title of the album, Taming the Tiger, is also the title of one of the songs on the album. I haven't seen the cover of the album, but I suspect that it's a painting of yours.
Yeah, there's a lot of paintings on the cover this time.
Okay. Is the painting Taming the Tiger?
Well, kind of loosely. It's just a picture of myself and my cat, El Cafe, who is one of my dancing cats. And she's
along with
reclining
Nietzsche.
Along with Nietzsche. They don't dance together, though. It's two different kinds of dance. El Cafe is a wrist rider. She's kind of an equestrian. You know, like
she yeah, rides her wrist.
She rides my wrist. Yeah, she neck reins. But anyway, she's reclining, kind of like Cleo, and she's got a very Jack Benny look on her face, and like, you know, like Cleopatra on the Nile, like lying in my arms, and it's kind of a, you know, kind of a cozy portrait, you know.
So we've met two of the cats. Who are the other two?
Pansy, that's my Canadian girl, that's Nietzsche's little wife, and Mojo, that's the youngest cat. Pansy, Mojo, El Cafe, and Nietzsche.
Okay. you had said there was sort of a link between Man from Mars and Taming the Tiger.
Well, Man from Mars was the first song born in the project, you know, like, and it took this personal loss for me to be able to get inside the character in order to write this song for the film. You know, like I said, now song two, I'm coming back to what I said originally, you know, I only have one song inside of me. I'm mad at show business, you know. So Taming the Tiger was kind of an analogy, but it was a big meditation. It was really, really hard to know what I meant by taming the tiger. I mean, I asked myself, you know, who is the tiger and what do you mean? Because it was complex. So for instance, Sophia says it's hard, the second verse, Sophia says it's hard to catch and harder still to ride. That's something Sophia Loren said. Sophia also means wisdom. You know, the name means wisdom. Sophia Loren said of show business, you know, hard enough to catch the tiger, harder still to stay on its back, right? So using the analogy of the tiger, you know, for metaphor for show business, as it is in the song, was terribly in danger of being a mixed metaphor. You know, I had to keep focusing myself. What do you mean by the tiger? What do you mean by the tiger?
This is while you're writing it, or in afterwards looking
while
back?
I'm writing it, while I'm meditating on the song. Parking the words to the music requires a lot of meditation, and this was a big idea, a big meditation. You know, who is the tiger? What is the tiger? Is the tiger show business? You know, well, it definitely was this force, that this negative force that I found coming against my music at the moment that I completed the project and turned it over to the company, you know, so that the process went from, you know, work and excitement, you know, excited work, enthusiastic work with a support system, into the hands of hostiles, You know, for one reason or another, we're going to dismiss a lot of beauty as they had for many years. You know, you're given about 5 years in this game, and then it's, for whatever reason, chronological age, it's time to get your ass because we were nice the last time. All the games that one must endure in the process of staying in this business, riding the tiger for a long time. You know, I finally got sick of it. I wanted off desperately, you know, and yet I was still good at it and hadn't perhaps even hit my stride. And that was the thing that I was also weighing out, you know, being responsible to my gift, you know, knowing that there were people not enough to impress the bean counters, you know, and not enough to get the merchants, the mercantile factor, to announce with pride that there was a project coming out on me, you know, that I was getting rolled over, that I had lost my airplay for swinging too far into jazz, or no one could ever really give me a reason. But my imitators were all over the airwaves, but I was still barred, you know. And yet my name was up and everywhere. So it was just, I was finally fed up. It was being misconstrued that I was, you know, worried about these young girls nipping at my heels. Not at all. But you know, they were getting, I was unable to get my product to market, and nobody could explain why. You know, so what was the point?
Outside to breathe the air and stare up at the stars. Big Dipper hanging there over the rental car. Over the rental car. I'm a runaway from the red curb biz, from the hoots and the hood and the whiny white kids. To catch and harder still to ride. The time to watch the beast the best is when it's purring at your side. Purring at your side. Accolades and honors, one false move and you'll rock on her. As the radio blared so bland, every disc a poker chip, every song just a one night stand. Formula music, girly girl, genuine junk food for juveniles. Up and down the dial, mercenary style. Watch the stars chuck down their spears, and a plane went blinking by. And I thought of a Hana, wild and dear, like fireworks in the sky. Fireworks in the sky. I'm so sick of this game. It's hip, it's hot. Life's too short. The whole thing's gotten boring. Kitty, kitty, run!
called Taming the Tiger. That's the name of the album as well. It's a new work from Joni Mitchell. I'm Chris DeRitas. Morning Becomes Eclectic on KCRW. Joni Mitchell is with us. This album is not coming out for months now.
July, I think.
July.
Yeah.
Just so people know that they shouldn't be going to the record stores tomorrow, but in fact, wait a couple of months. Everything that we heard on that track was you.
Yeah, that's mostly it's guitar-based, VG8-based, but then most of the orchestration is sweetened on this keyboard with, you know, so it's two instruments.
Got a couple of toys.
A lot of colors on them, yeah.
You've talked at length about, you know, how you've gotten reinvigorated for the making of this record and the fact that the record came about from being reinvigorated. And I wonder if the recent recognition has played a part in that as well. It seems as though since we saw you last here, there had been, you know, a couple of Grammys for Turbulent Indigo, Best Pop Album.
Still, the record didn't sell enough units to recoup the cost of making it. You know, for some reason, you know, no one can explain why, the machinery doesn't gear up. It's not like a movie that wins an Oscar and ads are taken and people go to see it. Somehow, they're, you know, like, so...
So that wind didn't really propel any kind of push?
Business is a very conservative gambler, and I'm over 50. They don't gear up much, I think, for people over 30, let alone people over 50. The assumption is that the market is very young, you know, that my generation no longer buys much records. I don't even think they address my generation. My generation comes up. My generation, for the most part, I don't think knows I'm still in the business, you know. Unless they're kind of avid fans and passing it on to their children, as some people are, you know.
It's tough to reach those people because a lot of them have gone away from radio, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They don't listen
to
radio.
Radio sucks.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was just trumped up, you know, to make the Grammys look good. I really do. It doesn't feel to me like a genuine victory. None of these things do. And I thought, you know, I'm kind of arrogant. Of course, I have French blood, you know, so it's in the genes. But I thought that, you know, if I was to get a little recognition within the industry, you know, that it would help my arrogance some. But it didn't at all. It just made it worse because all of the wins, there was just something like that about them. They just didn't. You know, I mean, this business is all based on appearances. If, you know, it looks like I won, I should shut up, shouldn't I? But most people would be quite happy looking like they won something. But I don't know. I don't feel like I've really won anything. Except for people who genuinely love my music. When I can tell, you know, I get my strokes from people who just like, oh, it's a celebrity, let's go talk to her. You know, and those people who it really meant something to. That's my honor, you know.
There's been a lot of, it seems, attention paid you lately, which has been nice to see. You know, even Janet Jackson, of course, borrowing from Big Yellow Taxi for her.
I really like that record. I really like the play of the three voices and the beat. You know, I was very proud and pleased to be a part of that project.
Joni Mitchell never lies.
Makes you want to cut down a cherry tree.
There is a quote I read once recently. It says, this is from you. When I sit down to write a song, I have to introvert and introvert because I like to scrape a little bit of how I'm feeling against the backside of what's happening around me. When you came in here, you talked about how this record was in large part love songs.
Mm-hmm. Running through it as a love story,
Yeah. It's not as though at every turn, the songs are autobiographical, and in fact, I would think that at some point you get irritated by people trying to see too much of you in the songs.
Well, they have that safety valve. If they want to see me in there, they can, but I think it's better for them, if they can, to see themselves in them. Mm. You know, it is a mirror that I'm holding up, whether it comes from my experiences or someone else's. You know, And I think that the most value is gained not by is by seeing yourself in the situation, just like in any movie or any work of art. You know, the more you can bring of your own experience to it, the richer it will be for you experientially as a work of art. You know, so the pop concern, you know, I'm a fine artist in a certain way working in a pop arena. The pop concern with, you know, the more superficial aspects of it, like who your hairdresser and your dresser and your trainer and your boyfriend and your, you know, all of that crap, you know, which, you know, I'm fatigued with, you know, and it's ruined a generation. I mean, I think, you know, these concerns. I just wish that people would look more at the art and less at the artist.
Mm. Yeah, because I was thinking that, you know, it'd be easy for somebody to be looking for songs in this project that might be influenced by your finding your daughter, for example.
Mm, I haven't had time to digest that. You know, I mean, Killoran and Marlon, my grandson, you know, came in the midst of making this project, and you know, I'd work a few weeks, and then we'd take off a few weeks, and we'd do things, and then I'd work a bit more, and then we would rendezvous again, and we'd take off some more time. And that time was all, you know, so joyous and so experiential. You know, writing takes withdrawal and introspection, and I just haven't had time. You know, between the commitments that I had prior to their arrival and the time actively spent with them, you know, when they're with me, I haven't had any contemplative time.
Crazy Cries of Love, this one's a collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a... In my hometown it lives another singer-songwriter, Don Freed, and it's his text for the most part. I
really
tweaked the choruses a little bit.
Have you
added
ever,
some syncopation.
You ever done that before? That kind of...
Yeah, Crosby, I took... well, this was more... Don had written this pretty much, except for the choruses, which I changed. But the verses were his, and there was an extra verse, which I eliminated because it was more gender-oriented, you know, so that I could sing it. It had something about admiring her neck, you know, like from more of a male perspective. You know, I don't go around looking at the nape of men's necks so much. But I just loved, you know, the flirtatiousness of it. And because we come from the same town, I imagined this song taking place on one of the train bridges. Like Saskatoon, where we come from, is called the City of Bridges.
Well, Don is also the inspiration behind Happiness is the Best, or Facelift, as it's now called.
Yeah, Don's my boyfriend. They weren't the winding type, so they went up on the train bridge where the weather was howling. Oh, oh, my, my. When that train comes rolling by, no paper thin walls, no folks about, no one else can hear the crazy cries of love. They were dancing in the rain. They knew their love was a strong one when they heard the far-off whistle of a train. They were hoping it was gonna be a long one, 'cause oh, oh, my, my. When that train comes rolling by, no paper thin walls, no folks about, no one else can hear the crazy cries of love. In the back booth of an all-night cafe, two dripping raincoats are hanging. Outside in the weather, the
shade on the street light is clanging. And they smile in the ear and I die. Ice cream is melting on a piece of pie. Sweet and strong. Every touch was totally tender. As the train came rumbling along, he sang a lover's song, wild abandon. Oh, oh my, my. When that train comes rolling by, no people thin walls, no folks above, no one else can hear the crazy cries of love. No people thin walls, no folks above, no one else can hear the crazy cries of love.
Crazy Cries of Love. That's from Joni Mitchell's new release, Taming the Tiger, due from Reprise this coming July. Joni Mitchell is with us. I'm Chris DeRitas. It's Morning Becomes Eclectic. There seems to be a sense of optimism for this album.
For it or in
In it. You know, I came away from my first listen to the album feeling uplifted.
Yeah, it's heavy in a way, but it's heavy in a light way. I think that's what, you know, my spirit is quite light these days, generally speaking, you know, like I, life begins at 50. You know, you have a lot of stuff worked out and things, and you worry in a different way, or, you know, because there are still worrisome things, but you seem to know yourself pretty well. You know, you can't get thrown curves. I don't know. I really have enjoyed my 50s, and especially the company of this person, who is the other singer-songwriter from my hometown, so that even though it's a kind of an autumnal romance, there's a very teenage thing about it, because we hung around the same places in our young and formative years, the Avenue H Pool Jukebox, the CM Lunch, which was like a kind of a Happy Days diner place with a jukebox. He and I hung around the jukeboxes because we were going to become the songwriters of our town. And it gives us a history back into the 50s and 60s. We were in the same places, even though he's my junior by about 6 years, so we wouldn't really... He would notice me, but I wouldn't notice him so much because of, 16 to 10.
Yeah.
That's what sociologically what happens. But, I feel optimistic that the return of my family with all of the joys and difficulties that entails, is a magnificent gift, at this time in my life. I feel optimistic personally. I'm enjoying my life. I have good friends, excellent friends, tried and true over a long period of time. And, I have family. The muse is still with me. And the painting is going well,
Any exhibits coming up?
I haven't had time, it's hard enough with this one career. I really haven't had time to launch an exhibit, but a lot of offers internationally. And
It surprised me when you described yourself as a painter first. I didn't realize
always.
That you'd thought of it that
Even
way.
In the music, if you go back and follow it, I am a lonely painter. Always. I've always been a painter. So my identity is fully forged as a painter. This is my straight job.
Well, it's great to see that you're going to be on stage soon. You're going to be part of the Stormy Weather show that's coming up at the Wiltern.
Yeah.
Sort of like a...
That'll be fun.
Yeah, it sounds like...
Big band.
A big band evening and
lots
fancy
dress and a couple of, Nice standards.
That's April 16th at the Wiltern, and you'll be sharing the stage with Dylan and Van Morrison in late May. You close the album with a Sons of the Pioneers song. My Best to You.
My Best to You. A Goodwill song. Yeah, I think I heard it. I went to the supermarket and I bought up in Canada, and I bought the Sons of the Pioneers Greatest Hits, and I came home and I was cooking and I was listening to it. And this is a very isolated place next to the ocean, way up, you know, north of Vancouver. And I'm cooking and listening to this thing. When the song came on, I got a lump in my throat, and I really didn't want to have a lump in my throat at that moment. And I went to shut it off, and I couldn't. So I walked outside. I just tried to distance myself from it, but I got right to the distance where I couldn't hear it very well, but I could still hear it. I couldn't get away from it. I couldn't shut it off, and I couldn't get away from it. And I realized that that song was really important to me at that moment, whether I liked it or not. Also, when I was blocked, people would come up to me in supermarkets and things, say, "I love your music, Joni," and I'd say, you know, "When's your next record coming out?" "Oh, I don't know. I'm blocked. What should I write about?" And people, 9 times out of 10, said, "Give us hope." And my answer at that time, because it was like, it was kind of bleak, but I said, you know, hope, why would I be giving you hope? They kill people in this culture that give hope. Or hadn't you noticed, you know? Which is true, isn't it, you know?
Yeah.
So, but anyway, when I heard that song, I thought, well, now, wait a minute, you know, that song gives me hope. It, and you know, two men have cried to that. One of them 4 times in a row, and the 5th time he got up and danced around the room to avoid it. So the song has that power. I find it very moving. It's sentimental without being cornball. I mean, some people might think it's cornball, but I needed this cornball at this time in my life. I couldn't write it, so I borrowed it.
I can't thank you enough for bringing this stuff in so way in advance of the record.
Oh, you're really welcome.
Really, really wonderful to hear it. And thanks for sharing it with us.
All right.
Joni Mitchell, it's KCRW's Morning Becomes Eclectic. The album's Taming the Tiger.
Dreams come true. May old father time never be unkind. And through the years, save your smiles and your tears. They're just souvenirs. They'll make music in your heart. Each new day is a kiss sent from up above with an angel's love. So here's to you. May your skies be blue and your love blessed. That's my best.
We're listening to Joni Mitchell from Taming the Tiger. The album is out in July on Reprise Records. Again, my thanks to Joni Mitchell for joining us.